This is episode number 150 of the Fearless Presentations podcast, the fastest, easiest way to eliminate public speaking fear.
Want to absolutely eliminate public speaking fear? This podcast is the answer. Here's the guy who literally wrote the book on Fearless Presentations, Doug Stannert.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fearless Presentations. I'm Doug Stannert, CEO of the Leaders Institute, and this is the podcast that helps you become a fearless and professional speaker and presenter. This is episode number 150. Wow, 150 episodes, and it's a continuation of the last episode where I talked about how I got into the speaking and training business or industry. This week, though, I'm going to talk about how I actually built my company, the Leaders Institute. And just so you know, the podcast is brought to you by Fearless Presentations and the Fearless Presentations classes. So in the last episode, I also talked about how we were beginning to open back up our in-person public speaking classes, which we're really excited about, by the way. And a couple of weeks ago, we had our second Dallas class. We've also have classes coming up in Houston, St. Louis, Las Vegas, Tampa, Atlanta, and Miami. We're booking all the classes, by the way, at airport hotels for the time being. So if you've been waiting to take one of these two-day public speaking classes and your city isn't quite open up fully yet, then feel free to travel into one of these classes if you like. We still have our virtual classes available, by the way. So for details, just go to fearlesspresentations.com. All right, so let's get on with today's podcast. And so in this episode, I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit and show you a few of the key things that happened in the early years of my company, the Leaders Institute. And just so you know, it took me 6 years of really intense training and learning and working with mentors before I felt comfortable enough to start my own company. And then my new team and I, after I started the new company, we spent another 6 years building up to the $1 million per year income mark. However, once we kind of figured out how to do it, we hit our second $1 million in just like 6 months after that. So basically, I'm gonna kind of pull back the curtain a little bit and show you how we did that. So in the late 1990s, I was having the time of my life, by the way. I was working for this huge multinational training company. It was kind of a dream job for me. It was one of those things that, I said in earlier episodes, I didn't set out to be a public speaker. I never set out to be a trainer. But once I got into the industry, it was like a dream come true. It was a really fun way to make a living. Every day I was learning new skills and I was growing as a business person and also as a teacher myself. And in fact, I was networking with some of the top consultants in the world on a day-to-day basis. So it was really a cool system that I was kind of entrenched in. So my income, by the way, was also growing every year, which was great because up until that point, you know, I'd been doing pretty well and then take a hit back on income. And then I do a little bit, I kind of talked about that on previous episodes, but at that point in my life and in my career, I was really starting to make some pretty good income. I was working with these high level people, networking with a lot of the movers and shakers within a lot of different industries and that kind of thing. So it was really, really fun. But just so you know, the company that I worked for had hundreds of franchises worldwide, huge, huge, huge company. And my boss was grooming me to purchase one of these franchises one day. And so I was really, really excited about the opportunity. And then that year, by the way, at our annual convention, I was having dinner with one of my counterparts who worked for a smaller franchise. I mean, Dallas was one of the bigger franchises. This guy was actually working in the Little Rock office, which was, you know, basically all of Arkansas. So it was a much smaller territory than what my boss had. And the more that I talked with this guy, the more that I realized that he was a top producer. So he was my counterpart there. He was one of these big producing guys. But he was flat broke. When I got back to my office, I looked up his franchise owner's sales numbers. You know, that was published on the intranet that we had. And after just a cursory scan, I realized that his boss was also flat broke. So he was making a fraction of what my boss was making. And my boss had a pretty good income and he was making some pretty good money. But it was kind of weird because I was a top producer in my boss's franchise. And so I was doing pretty well financially. However, most of my coworkers were not doing well at all. A lot of them were like under the poverty level and that kind of thing. So one of the things that I kind of figured out at that point was that a company's main purpose is to solve problems for customers. And so I was working for a company that was supposed to help people become more successful, but the company couldn't even help their own employees become more successful. And that didn't make sense to me. So that was one of those things where it was one of those moments, I call them like cloud parting moments, you know, where all of a sudden the clouds kind of part and you start seeing things a little differently. You start questioning things a little bit. And if you've ever seen the movie, The Sixth Sense, where at the end, the Bruce Willis character kind of I don't want to ruin it if you haven't seen it, but basically comes to a realization. And once he comes to that realization, he kind of starts replaying the things that happened in the movie, and you start seeing what really happened. So the theme of that movie is that we tend to see what we want to see, not necessarily what is reality. And that is until that moment of clarity hits us, and then everything becomes clearer. And that's what kind of happened to me after having that conversation with this guy at the convention. So my wife, her name's Leisha. So Leisha and I had dinner that night, and she could tell I was kind of in a real funk because all of a sudden my hopes and dreams were starting to get diminished pretty significantly. And, you know, while we were kind of talking, I was replaying the memories from the past year in my head, just like what the Bruce Willis character did in the movie. And one of the things that kind of popped into my head at that moment was that the company had spent 3 years rolling out an update to their main training program. Even a minor change took forever to implement for this company because we had over 3,000 teachers worldwide. So each of those trainers had to be retrained anytime there was even just a minor update. So as a result, by the time that update was completed, it was already out of date. So they were really missing out on opportunities in the marketplace. In fact, a lot of my income that previous year had come from custom classes that I had created based on a customer's need. The customer would tell me what they needed, and then I would actually create something for them because the programs that the company that I worked for were creating were not what the marketplace was really demanding at that time. And basically our customers were telling us exactly what they needed and exactly what they wanted, but the company wasn't really listening. Or if they were listening, they didn't have the ability to adapt on the fly and create the problem-solving things for the customers that we had. And then the next thing that I remembered was, I mentioned to Alicia, my wife, the conversation that I had with my coworker, Jim. Jim and I were kind of cohorts, you know, he was actually my mentor when I started learning to teach, and just a fantastic instructor trainer. And he and I had gone out to Starbucks one afternoon for coffee. And this was like a few months before the conversation I was having with my wife. And Jim had mentioned that there was this guy who used to work for the company, just like what we did. And he had gone out on his own about 10 years prior. And he had been talking with Jim about jumping ship, you know, quitting the company and working for him for months. And So once that kind of clicked, I was like, well, maybe this guy is doing something different. I mean, basically he's a smaller company, so he's able to adapt a little bit faster. So I wonder if he's doing something different. So basically, what I did was I contacted Ken within a few weeks. He and I were having lunch together, and we really hit it off, by the way. Nice guy, just a fantastic instructor trainer. And I told him about the frustration that I was feeling, and he just kind of laughed because he said, that's the same way it was when he left a decade before. And in fact, I mean, I can't really tell you this word for word, but this is what I kind of remember him saying. He said, hey, Doug, you work for a company who is supposed to help people become more successful. The company has over 4,000 employees and contractors. However, half of those people live below the poverty line. And then he said, look closely at the revenue in the annual reports. And he said, only a handful of franchise owners are going to be millionaires. The rest have spent a ton of money on franchises that compete against each other, right? And so basically what he kind of told me at that lunch meeting was the same thing that I had come to the conclusion on my own. with the, you know, a couple of weeks prior to that. And by the way, he'd been in business for about 10 years or so. He had developed a handful of really loyal customers, but he was telling me that he had recently started doing classes for a local chapter of a national trade association. It was a construction association, commercial construction. And a couple of his clients basically were on the board of this local chapter, and they brought him in to do training classes for the association members. So basically what would happen was the members paid a discounted fee to take Ken's classes, and then the association kept some of the proceeds as a fundraiser. So it was like a win-win-win for everybody. The association got a fundraiser, Ken got income and got new customers and clients, and then the members got a discounted training program. So it was a pretty good deal. Well, the Dallas chapter was in the process of merging with the Fort Worth branch of the same association. They were combining those two offices, and they wanted Ken to teach his leadership classes in Fort Worth as well. So Ken, you know, because he was pretty busy, he offered to let me have that client in Fort Worth in exchange for a small portion of the revenue that I generated. So it was a really cool deal. I mean, it was basically, if I wanted to go out on my own, I wouldn't have any customers. I mean, I couldn't take customers with me because they were the company that I worked for. Those customers belonged to the company I worked for. So he was basically helping me get started, and it was kind of a windfall for me because it was one of those things that if I hadn't had that, it would have been much tougher to got to get started. So in March of 2000, I quit my job. I put my house up for sale. I rented a cheap apartment in the ghetto of Fort Worth. Luckily, the house didn't sell right away, so Alicia was able to kind of stay in the house, and then I would come back to Dallas on the weekends and that kind of thing. So that first year, by the way, that I was in business was pretty lean to tell you, to say the least. I did not make a whole lot of income, went into great debt. But the association, they gave me a list of their members, and email was around back then. You know, this was in the early 2000s. So email was around, been around for quite a while by then, but the association didn't have emails for every one of its members. And a lot of their members, because they were construction folks, didn't really respond well to email. So basically, Alicia and I printed out brochures for the upcoming class and printed, you know, brochures. And then we sent the brochures to all of the members once a month for like 3 months via postal mail. So we got the mailing list, and it was torture, by the way. That's a dumb way to kind of build a class, but you know, it was all we knew how to do. And by the way, I spent every day calling each of those members. I had a list of members. I called them every day. You know, there were hundreds of them, so I would call, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 a day, and then work until I got to the end of the list. And then once I got to the end of the list, I called them again. Right. So that was like the technique that I was using, and I was setting up appointments to go visit with each of these folks in person. As any of them that would let me come visit with them, tell them about the class, I would do that. So after about 3 months, we had absolutely no income coming in during that 3 months. And I had a lot of new expenses. But I also had enough people in to hold my first class. So basically the fees were being paid to the association. So once we started the class, the association would pay me. So basically I went 3 months without any pay, hoping that we were going to get enough people in this class to kind of fill it up. And I generated about $10,000 in revenue for that first class, which was not bad, but I spent over $4,000 on printing and postage. So my net for the class was about $6,000. Still not bad, I guess, for the very first time that I tried to do a class. But since it took me 3 months to fill it up, I figured I was making, you know, that's only about $2,000 profit of a month. And that only came out to be about $24,000, you know, if I'd have been working a 40-hour work week, that would have amounted to about $11 per hour. But I was actually working, you know, 60 to 80 hours per week. So I was generating less than like half a minimum wage almost. It was crazy. But I'd make my calls and I'd run my appointments during the business day. Then Alicia and I would stuff and lick envelopes over pizza in the evening. So it was challenging, but you know, it became kind of a family thing, right? It became, I was going to say fun. It wasn't fun at all, but it became a part of what we did, right? So after that first association class, though, I realized that I probably couldn't schedule another one right away. So I scheduled a course that was open to the general public. That's how I started doing the public classes, kind of like what we do with Fearless Presentations now. So I placed ads in the local newspaper and the business journal to get new customers. That was another expense. In addition, I spoke at the local business breakfasts and joined 3 different chambers of commerce and became an ambassador and all that kind of stuff. And we sent out lots of mailers and I did lots and lots and lots of cold calls. I mean, I was on the phone all day long. I was going out on appointments all day long. And at the end of that, 2 or 3 months that it took me to do that second class, I generated about $7,500 and my expenses were much higher. So I actually made less profit the next 3 months than what I did the first 3. So wasn't really working out well for me that first year. Like I said, it was really lean that year since I'd worked for that previous company for the first couple of months of the year. I think I netted about 27 grand, which was about a quarter of what I was making at the company when I left. So it was a big hit on income, but my thought process was, hey, we're building for the future. We're going to make this into something big. Right. So that the company made it through that first year, but really just barely, and since I knew for a couple of years that I would need to save money, I knew that for a while before I left the company that I didn't want to add in new expenses. I didn't want because I knew that sooner or later I was going to go out on my own. I was going to need that income. I was going to need that savings. And so I kept my 8-year-old Toyota Corolla way past the time I should have traded it in. And then about that same time, the air conditioning went out on it. So it was miserable. I mean, that first year was really miserable. Our house, by the way, had finally sold. That helped a lot because up until that point, I was paying a mortgage and paying the rent on the ghetto apartment, plus all the gas to go back and forth and double utilities and all that kind of stuff. So once the house sold, we Alicia and I stayed in that ghetto apartment for a little while before we moved into to our new home in Tarrant County in Fort Worth anyway. So, and by the way, Alicia was a trooper through the whole process. I mean, I know she did not sign up for this when she married me. About that time at the end of that first year, we found out that Alicia was pregnant with our daughter, Colleen. And so basically we were living in that ghetto apartment on a fold out couch, the two of us on the fold out couch. And she never complained, so she's like I said, she was a real trooper. Somehow, by the way, we convinced the bank to give us a new mortgage and we moved into this small kind of starter home in on the Tarrant County side of the Metroplex about 3 weeks after Colleen was born. But money was really tight. So basically Ken and I would talk quite often about ways to grow faster in the business or make the businesses grow faster. And I mentioned to him, some of the needs that my customers had at the previous company, that basically a lot of those custom programs that I had been designing, I was kind of telling about some of those things that I'd done. A lot of them were related to public speaking and presentation skills and stuff like that. And he was open to the idea, but after a while, I kind of realized that Ken was kind of stuck in the past. He didn't use or teach people how to use technology in their presentations. He didn't own a projector. He didn't use PowerPoint or anything like that. I mean, that was at the time, that was kind of the new thing, right? I mean, this was late 90s, early 2000s. And so that was kind of cutting edge technology back then, but he was still using boards and he was still using flip charts and stuff like that. So, and that's what he was teaching people how to use, so he was basically a couple of decades behind in some of that stuff. And he wasn't really creating custom things for his customers. He had this manual that he created probably 10, 15 years prior to the time that I met him. And he had photocopied it like 15 times. And so the photocopies weren't really nice looking. And then they were in like a 3-ring binder. So it was really amateurish, really. So nothing was really tailored to the needs of the client. So I think one of the main challenges that he had, though, was that he had worked for the same company that I'd worked for years. And so his idea of a business structure was identical to the company that he left, right? That we both left. So he brought me in to teach classes in Fort Worth because the company that we both used to work for had a franchise in Dallas and also had a franchise in Fort Worth. And so he believed that he had to create franchise-like offices, and that was the way he could grow his company. And that's what the big company did. So that's what he needed to do as well. Not realizing that that process or that thing that the big company was doing was what was holding them back from being able to do what the customers really wanted anyway. But anyway, I kind of hung in there, and eventually the business hit a small growth spurt. Since I needed more customers and I wasn't really locked in to the same kind of mentality that Ken was, or the company that I worked for was, I asked my contact at the Fort Worth Association to introduce me to her counterpart down in Houston. It seemed like a no-brainer to me. We were doing so well in Dallas and in Fort Worth that, you know, let's go to some other cities and do the same thing. So set up an appointment to meet with her at her office. And I told her about the success that we were having in Dallas and Fort Worth. And we'd also done a class or two down in Austin by that time. But she was really skeptical because this was a much bigger location of the association than even in Dallas. So this was, I'm assuming that she probably got people like me popping into her office all the time, wanting her to promote their stuff. And so she was really skeptical, and I can understand that. So I was a little patient. But while I was in Houston, though, I called on a couple of offices of my Dallas-Fort Worth customers who had offices down in Houston as well. So there were some companies that were big, really big in Texas that have offices in Austin and in Dallas and Houston. And some of those were my customers. So I called on the ones that were down there. And also made a few cold calls while I was down there. So I wanted to make use of my time. So I made a few cold calls to potential customers and everything. So 2 months later, I taught a public version of the class, just like what I'd been doing in Dallas. I taught a public version of the leadership class that we had designed. And most of the participants, by the way, were members of this Houston Association. So on the day of the last session of class, I set up a follow-up appointment with Susan, the lady that worked at the association. And this was, maybe 2 hours or so after I finished the last session. I had exit surveys from that class, and I just brought a stack of those exit surveys with me and kind of showed them to her. And she slowly and meticulously went through them one by one. She's looking at the names. She recognizes these names because some of these people are like VPs of the companies that are members of her association. So she recognizes them. She sees the five stars and all that kind of stuff. And so it was funny because I was terrified because she would have been a really good, probably is a really, really good poker player, because I really couldn't tell whether or not I was persuading her or offending her by kind of doing this. But it was funny because she paused and she said, "Hey, it seems to me whether or not I say yes or no, you're going to pretty much do the classes anyway." And I kind of nodded my head yes. And she said, "So if I say yes, the association receives some revenue. And if I say no, we don't. So I guess I better say yes." And she smiled when she said it. I was like, oh my God, there was such relief that hit over me, because I thought for sure I'd just blown it. I thought for sure that this was going to be the end of my, I thought for sure she was going to call up the lady that I was working for in Fort Worth and tell, "You got to get rid of this jerk. He's not really good." But it turned out to be a really good, really positive thing. So I spent the next couple of months driving down to Houston, staying in cheap hotels, and calling on Susan's members, the members of this association. Now, like, keep in mind, this whole time I was flat broke. I mean, I was starting, the debt was starting to creep up and for me and my family. And I remember traveling down to Houston with less than like $100 to my name. And I had to pay for a hotel and food and gas. I remember stopping into the McDonald's, you know, like 40 miles outside of Houston, or 40 miles outside of Huntsville anyway. And I found one of these traveler guides, the coupon books, you know. And I found a coupon for a hotel for $47 a night. And I was like, oh man, okay, I got to do that, because that'll help me, you know, if I'm eating McDonald's and paying for $47 hotel nights, I might be able to kind of do this one more time if I need to. I mean, yeah, that's me. I was living the high life back then. I mean, that's that first couple of years, how tough they were. But the thing to kind of keep in mind about this is that that whole time I was building something, that whole time I was creating something. And I spent a lot of time early on perfecting my skill, you know, to getting really good at helping people reduce public speaking fear, getting really good at helping people develop those leadership skills. And after you've kind of done that, there's going to be a process that you're going to have to learn in order to learn how to operate your business, which is what I was going through at the time. I mean, I knew how to teach, but I didn't really know how to run a business yet. And so during that time period, there are going to be setbacks. So at the start of the third year, by the way, it was exciting. I mean, things were really clicking. First year really sucked. Second year, okay. You know, started to get out of debt and everything. Third year though, bang, man, things were kind of booming. It was just me. Well, I say me, but you know, my wife was doing a lot of the bookkeeping and stuff like that for me. I had the new baby, so it was a little tougher. But I was still teaching a couple of classes every year for the association in Fort Worth. So that was still going pretty strong. In addition to that, I had three classes scheduled in Houston, which was great, you know, because I'd already done, you know, maybe one or two by that point in Houston the previous year. And the word was really starting to spread. I was having more and more customers coming to me versus me having to go out and find them. People would say, oh man, I need to go to that leadership course. And man, Doug is really good and that kind of thing. So that year, by the way, I began teaching for the local association chapter in Indianapolis as well, because like I said, the word had started to spread that this was good for the members and it was a good fundraiser for the association, that kind of thing. And by the end of that year, I had contracts to do classes in Fort Worth. And then the next year in 2003, six classes in Houston. So we doubled the number of classes that we were doing in Houston, and then two more in Indianapolis. And then I also added on Madison, Wisconsin and Chicago. So it was freaking awesome. I mean, it was like, for the first time I had my head above water and, you know, things were starting to cook. And I was still in debt, but the contracts that I'd already booked for that 2003 year, toward the end of 2002, those contracts for the next year totaled over $250,000, which was, I mean, that was unheard of for me. I mean, I never thought of being able to make that much money just me by myself. So in just 3 years, by the way, I had more than doubled the revenue that Ken had generated in any of his 10 years in business, right? So, and my company was still growing. So I was still adding new customers. I was still adding new locations. So at that same time, Ken, you know, he was doing his six classes a year in Dallas. And think about the mentality that he had. So his idea of growth was to bring on a single person like me in different cities. That's what he saw at the, company that we worked with before. It never dawned on him that he could go to the different cities himself until I did it. And that was like, I talked about my own cloud parting moment when I kind of saw the light at the other company. I think this was Ken's cloud parting moment as well. Cause at this point, Ken kind of stopped seeing me as a partner and he began to see me as a competitor because I was way ahead of him. I was getting introduced to these different associations really, really quick. And so that led to what I call the year of despair. It was, you know, our relationship, Ken and I, our relationship kind of devolved pretty quickly. I spent a couple of years, you know, living in poverty to build something big. You know, those first couple of years that I was in business, I lived in poverty because I knew that I was building something. I knew that I was growing. And eventually, Ken kind of tried to take back his customer. I mean, the association was his customer, and he kind of thought of, you know, he could go out and try to get these associations himself, or he could just call up the associations I was already doing business with and try to cash in on all of the upcoming contracts. And so it was really messy, by the way. And it's funny when I bring this up to, I don't bring it up to Leisha much, but when I bring up this year to Leisha, she kind of rolls her eyes because she's like, God, you are such an idiot sometimes, right? So we two grown men that teach leadership skills, acting like children was pretty much probably the best way to describe that year. But it was a lot of turmoil and stress and things like that. So basically, in that, even though I had that $250,000 worth of contracts lined up, most of those fell by the wayside. Madison, Wisconsin, and Houston, Fort Worth, all three of those kind of canceled their classes for 2003 before we even got started. Indianapolis and Chicago stayed with me. But they were the smaller ones, right? So I was basically starting over from scratch without Houston. You know, a lot of the income was kind of gone. So that year, by the way, one of my new customers at the time was Capital One, and they hired me to do a few in-house classes. And in addition, since Ken was out of the picture now, you know, since he and I were no longer partners, then I began to teach the Fearless Presentations classes that I'd created in Dallas for the first time. And that was a big plus as well, but it was a slow rebuild. I was basically starting over from scratch the third year that I was in, or after 3 years anyway. And a debt again was starting to mount up just before Christmas. This was kind of the low point because throughout that year, like I said, it was mostly stressful and some positive stuff, but a lot of negative as well. But Leisha kind of came up to me and she said, "Hey, Doug, this is not working. We cannot keep living like this." And a friend of ours, both of us, a friend of ours, her name was Mary. She was the vice president of human resources at a big company in Dallas. And Leisha suggested that I call Mary and see if she might have a job for me. And I knew that she had been really, like I said, she'd been a stalwart for like 3 years. And just when it looked like we were starting to make things happen, it kind of turned. And so I knew with the new baby and the added expenses and the house and all that kind of stuff, I knew that we probably needed to do something new. So I called Mary. I stared at the phone for like an hour. I don't know how long it was, but I just stared at the phone going, "Oh man, I got to, anyway." And when I dialed her number and connected, she recognized my voice right away, obviously. And she said, "Wow, man, I was meaning to call you." And I was kind of shocked. It was like, because we hadn't talked in, a couple of years at that point. And she said, "Yeah, a couple of weeks ago," she said, "I got word that I was being laid off. And I was wondering if I could come work for you." And we both kind of laughed when I told her why I was calling her. So it was one of those things where if Mary had been in a better position and she had been able to hire me, the Leaders Institute probably would have never existed the way it is now anyway. It probably would have kind of gone by the wayside. I would be stuck in a corporate job, kind of working for somebody else for the rest of my life. But that was kind of it's funny how a lot of times when I kind of look back on over the things that happened, I don't think anything happens by accident. I know that God played a huge part in everything that went on. And a lot of these things that I'm talking about that I screwed up on were times when he was telling me to do something. I was doing the exact opposite because I wanted to do it my way and that kind of thing. But that kind of started the road to recovery. And that's where the things that I learned in that next year made it to where I was able to get to that $1 million mark so much faster. So it was basically because I had been behind the eight ball for so long now, I didn't have any choice. I had to come out swinging, right? So, and by the way, I remember the day that this happened on December 30th, 2003, I got just a random phone call from an assistant at a company called 3D International in Houston. And basically this assistant was saying that his vice president was looking for a speaking coach or somebody to do public speaking classes for a team of construction guys who were competing for a project. And since that was New Year's Eve anyway, so the next day, which was New Year's Eve, I drove down to Houston for a 1 p.m. appointment with them. And it turns out that this was an engineering company. It was a commercial engineering company, which since I had been working in the commercial construction business for the last two or three years with the association down in Houston, I knew a lot of the people that they knew. But this engineering company had been what they called shortlisted for a project. And I had never heard of the term at that point. So I had to kind of ask them for a little bit of explanation. But to kind of explain it, when a school district or a city or a big company, a municipality, whatever company wants to build something, they will typically send out a request for proposal to a number of different organizations, a number of different builders or engineering firms, whatever, right? And then some group of people, some committee will go through all of the proposals and they will kind of pick out the ones that are, that they think are best suited to kind of lead this project or be awarded this project. And that's what they call the shortlist. So they create this, this list. They may take the 30 proposals and shortlist it down to 3 to 8 different potential customers or potential vendors anyway. And then the shortlisted candidates will, a lot of times will be asked to give a presentation to the committee to show why they should be awarded the contract. Now, just so you know, these shortlist presentations, they, if you do really, really well on them, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get the contract, but if you do poorly in them, it'll guarantee you don't get it. So it's basically, it could be a weeding out set, technique to get rid of the a few more candidates off the, get a few more candidates off the short list. In some cases though, it's to award the contract. They're looking for the team that they think they can work best with so that they can award this big $1 billion, multi-$1 million, $100 million contract, depending on the project. So every once in a while, I kind of mentioned this before, every once in a while something happens in life where I'm just absolutely sure that God is in charge of everything. And this is one of those times. So that association that Ken had connected me with and I'd spent time with for the last 2 years was the Associated General Contractors. I'd spent the last 3 years teaching public speaking classes to commercial general contractors in Houston, right? And then after this short meeting with the assistant, and by the way, in addition to that, I also had years, you know, close to a decade now of sales experience. And these are, and these engineers were going to be doing a sales presentation. So basically everything just kind of clicked. And after a short meeting with the assistant, he kind of left the room. He brought back in the VP that he was kind of doing the interview for. And after a few minutes speaking with the vice president, then the CEO kind of popped in the room and the VP kind of looked at the CEO and he said, "Hey, I think this is our guy." And I was like, he'd already made the decision just based on that, that discussion because of my experience, because of all those things. There's no way that could have happened by accident. That was like the biggest moment of despair in the history of the company. And all of a sudden, the perfect customer showed up and called me and invited me down. And within 24 hours, I'd kind of closed the contract. So a few weeks after that, in mid-January anyway, I was doing the first session for this group. And then a week after that, there was a spur of the moment kind of thing that popped up where the CEO himself hired me to come down and coach his group down in Austin. And once I kind of did that, the CEO just absolutely loved my coaching. He loved it so much that he promoted me to all of his locations. And for the next 3 or 4 years, I coached over a dozen teams from those offices. So, by the way, the first one that I did was pretty good, better than what they'd ever done before. The second one though, once I kind of knew what I was doing, we nailed it. And that was the one that the CEO was in. And I got better and better and better at these. And in fact, over the years that I was working with this particular company, they closed about 80% of those contracts. So that when they got on the short list, 80% of the time they ended up getting the job because of the coaching that I was doing with them. And as a result, the company kind of grew at this exponential rate and over the next few years anyway. And in fact, a lot of those guys that I trained became millionaires when their company was bought out by a larger construction company, you know, 3 or 4 years after this all started. So at the same time, by the way, I was continuing to do classes for Capital One and the associations in Indianapolis and Chicago. But the public Fearless Presentations classes started to take off as well, not only because of the things that I was learning by doing the classes with 3DI, but also since I was doing these classes, I was doing classes in Dallas and Houston, public classes, and I was also adding classes in New York and Los Angeles. And since it was just me, what I would do is I would experiment with each class. So when the things that I did that worked really, really well, I kept. And then if something didn't work really well, I just tossed it. So by the end of the year, I taught about 20 classes, and every single time that I taught a class, I got better and better and better. The class got better and better and better, and every time that I delivered it. So toward the end of that year, I received a call from a guy named Rick Highsmith. Rick became a pretty good friend over the years, and glad he was on the team, by the way, but he wanted to do some contract work for me as an instructor for the Leaders Institute. And at the time, I was exhausted, because at this time, things were really starting to cook again. It went from despair to like rapid growth because of all the stuff that I was learning, the things that I was being able to do. So I was really perfecting the skill at that moment again. But I was doing all the selling, I was doing all the traveling, I was doing all the teaching. And then in the evening time, I'd work on websites and do marketing. So I was working these really, really long hours. And I really needed help. So when Rick called me, I invited him to come to my next class, which happened to be in Los Angeles. And I didn't think he would show up, by the way, because Rick lives in Orlando. He lived in Orlando at the time, still does today. But he flew to California on his own dime just for the potential of getting a little contract teaching work, which was shocking to me. So he showed up, he got there. And by the way, this is what I call the day that I learned the secret to being a successful entrepreneur, although it took me about a year longer to realize it. So this is one of those things that once you kind of realize this, it makes your business grow pretty dramatically. Rick and I had lunch together in the middle of the second day of class. It was 2 days. The Fearless Presentations is a 2-day public speaking class. So he went through the whole first day and we kind of talked a little bit at breaks and we had lunch together and everything. But it was the second day when we had lunch that when he sat down, because he had seen what we'd done, what I'd done in the class. And he kind of, his eyes got really big when he was talking to me. He said, "This is absolutely amazing." He said, "First, number one, you got 12 people to take off work to go to a public speaking class. That in and of itself is pretty difficult." And he said, "Second, you made the whole process really fun. They're actually enjoying being here. They're actually, how do you make a public speaking class fun? Not many people can do that." And then he said, "Third, the most important thing is that these people really grew substantially in just a couple of days." And then he just kind of paused for a second. He said, "I'm in." And I kind of smiled at him. I said, "Okay, great. That makes two of us." And he almost fell out of his chair. He was like, "What?" You know, because he had seen all the classes that I had on my schedule and that I was teaching and all that kind of stuff. It was no way that one guy could do everything that I was doing. And so he had no clue that I was doing everything myself at the time. And in all fairness, by the way, like I mentioned before, Alicia was doing a lot of the invoicing and bill paying and follow-ups sometimes and that kind of thing too. So she was helping out a lot. She was forwarding me stuff through email if I was teaching a class and that kind of thing. So she helped out a lot. So basically what I did was I invested in a virtual PBX system and I forwarded incoming calls and forwarded emails to Rick on the days that I was teaching. And then after Rick started, it was funny because production didn't just double, it tripled, right? Our production went up threefold when he started, which was shocking to me because up until that point, I was thinking if I bring somebody else on, it's going to take money out of my pocket. When in reality, it was the exact opposite. That more money went into my pocket as a result of bringing Rick on. And Rick was so busy. He was contracting with two or three other companies at the time. And he stopped doing that just to kind of work with the Leaders Institute full-time at that point. So by that time, by the way, I had taught about 15 classes in all of 2004. And then the two of us taught that many in the next few months. We just couldn't keep up. So basically I brought in a recent college graduate the guy kind of out of the blue from Canada. He called me out of the blue and I needed somebody. So I kind of brought him on. And since we were doing a couple of classes every single week, this young kid fresh out of college taught more classes his first year than one of the instructors at my previous company would have taught an entire lifetime. That's how many classes that we were doing. So by the end of 2005, we had 6 instructors and we had delivered over 100 classes in a single year. And by 2006, we had a dozen instructors and we're delivering over 300 Fearless Presentations classes every year. Now, if I had to do it all over again, I would totally do it differently. Because of all the different lessons that I learned, if I started over from scratch right now, I'd be able to do it a whole lot faster and a whole lot easier. But a lot of those things that happened to me along the way were things that I needed to learn through the school of hard knocks kind of thing. And so, because that's how I knew what I was doing wrong, right? When I found out I was doing something wrong, I would kind of change. So let me give you the lessons learned here, because I think that's the thing that most people are going to be interested in here is so great. You got this story and it was really bad and now you've got to turn it around. So what is it that I can learn to help me build my own personal business? And so the first thing you have to know is just like what I've mentioned a couple of times on this episode is that God is totally in control. If you are building a business, you will experience challenges. I promise you. Each of those challenges will be a subtle push to change what you are doing. If you do not respond to those subtle pushes, those pushes will get more challenging. Keep that in mind. These pushes will sometimes, they won't make sense at the time that they occur, but they're going to make sense down the road. There'll be some things that will kind of push you to do something that will kind of make some big changes for you. And at the time that they occur, they really suck, by the way, right? When you have those challenges and you're in despair, it really stinks. I wish we didn't have to go through that, but a lot of times that's how we learn. That's how we kind of get better at running a business. So the second thing that's really important is you have to perfect your skill. You know, no one wants to work for somebody who just does a mediocre version of what somebody else is doing. So one of the things that made it easier for me to grow was that what we were doing was something that nobody else was doing. So we had a long line of people. If I ever needed to bring somebody on, I had 20, 30, 40 people that had sent me resumes in the last month that wanted to jump on board because we were doing something that nobody else was doing. So if you perfect that skill first, if you develop something that is unique, something that is totally different from what everybody else is doing, then it makes it a whole lot easier to grow. Number three is, and this is the real secret to success in business, it's to teach others your secret sauce. So once you perfected that skill, once I perfected my skill, I had just created a job for myself when it was just me. It wasn't until I brought Rick on that I actually created some wealth, you know, because basically I was just working, you know, 3 full-time jobs and getting paid, you know, probably what I would have made if I'd have done 3 full-time jobs, right? So, but once I've kind of brought Rick on and taught him to do what I was doing, now that all of a sudden that's when the income really started to kind of boost up. And it wasn't until we got to like the 4th or 5th one that it got to the point where at the end of the month, I had way more income than what I could spend. So it was great. The next one is you don't want to bring on new team members until you can support them, because sometimes I'll coach people and they'll say, okay, great. I just need to hire a bunch of new people. And then that's how we grow. Well, no, there's a balance there, because you need employees to grow your business. But if you just hire without actually having a need, you're going to go bankrupt. You're going to spend more. That's a huge, huge, huge cost. So you want to make sure that you wait until till everybody's busy, and then you take some load off of the folks who are there. And that's how you kind of continue to grow. And then the last one, and really is one of the more important ones, is that you want to focus on building your company infrastructure. This is one of the things that I failed to do for like the first 10 years or so of the company. Eventually your company is going to plateau at places. If you're a one person operation, or if you're a person and an assistant, you're going to top out at about the $300,000 mark. It's going to be very, very difficult for one or two people in an office to, or even working from home to increase their income more than three 100,000. Now, if you're doing digital stuff and you've got processes, you might be able to do that. But for most small businesses anyway, you typically kind of top out. The first one, by the way, is about 100 grand. You know what? That's before you bring on an assistant. You bring on an assistant, it goes up to about 300 grand. Once you start to bring employees on though, you'll typically hit the next plateau, which is about $1 million. For some reason, that's one of those mental barriers. When you hit that $1 million mark, a lot of times companies will kind of stall out there. The reason why that occurs is because we haven't created the infrastructure yet to support anything bigger. So that's when you want to start looking at things like somebody on a finance team, right? You hire a bookkeeper, right? You hire human resource people and marketing and a sales manager and stuff like that. You know, so basically that you're creating your executive team, and the more that the entrepreneur tries to do him or herself, the more it's going to stifle the growth. You got to bring on those experts to kind of help you grow. Really, the most important lesson, though, is that anybody can build a really big business in America. I mean, it can be done. Anybody can do it. It's not going to be easy, and you're going to get knocked down. And there'll be times that you'll feel like you want to give up or that you even have to give up. I mean, that happened to me. I almost did that. If Mary had said yes, I would not be in business today. However, that's the moment of truth. It's often that time, that's that moment that everything will kind of turn around for the better if you work hard and you have faith. So hopefully this has been inspiration for you. I hope it hasn't been, you know, too boring for you. And I hope you gain something out of it that will help you grow your business as well. So thanks a lot, guys, for being a part of Fearless Presentations. We'll see you next week. Bye, y'all.
Subscribe to this podcast for new public speaking secrets each week.